Frank's Red Hot is the perfect blend of flavor and heat, so you can use an entire bottle to make recipes like buffalo chicken dip or buffalo nachos, or even things that don't start with buffalo. Frank's Red Hot. I put that shit on everything.
Everybody, and welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Amazing Avenue's minor league podcast. I am Steve Saipa. I'm joined this week by Lucas Vlahos and Ken Lavin and Thomas Henderson. How's everyone doing this week?
I'm doing well.
Pretty good. I have no rooting interest in the football games, so I don't have to care, which is nice.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a weird sports time right now. We have like the Rangers and or Islanders and or Devils, depending on where you're from and who you're rooting for. But I mean, other than that, there's really just not much happening.
Hey, yeah. My Seattle Kraken are exceeding expectations. My 76ers are playing like the best team in basketball. And
so you're a Seattle fan?
Yeah, I wanted to get into hockey, and I didn't want to root for a James Dolan team, so I said, let me root for the expansion team. Also, they have a sick-ass logo. The fucking Kraken. It's great. So,
my sister is a Las Vegas Knights fan, and it brings our family so much shame. So much shame.
I will take my 10 seconds to say, give Joel Embiid the MVP immediately, and if he doesn't get one this year, it's bullshit. End discussion.
All right, so promote, extend, trade this week. I don't think this is the case, but are any of you guys Brazilian and or Portuguese?
No.
Not the last time I checked.
All right, so today is a special observance day for all of our Brazilian listeners out there.
Mm-hmm.
It is Dia da Saudade, which translates the Day of Saudade. And Saudade is a Portuguese word. It doesn't have an exact translation, but it's something that, A, as millennials, and B, as Mets fans, we can really understand. It hits hard. But it's basically like a romanticized, more intense version of like nostalgia. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what Saudades are we going to promote, extend, or trade? You know, the things that we really would want to bring back, things that we, you know, kind of want to bring back, or things that just whatever. So first we have the Who Let the Mets Out era Mets, like the 1998 to 2001 Mets or so, with the black uniforms, Mike Piazza trade, the best infield ever, Bobby V, all those things. Next we have the team, the time, the Mets era, from like 2005 to 2009. You have David and Jose, Pedro and Johan, the birth of SNY and Gary, Keith and Ron, the end of Shea Stadium, beginning of Citi Field. And then last, we have the Panic City era from like 2014 to 2018 or so, where you have Harvey, Wheeler, Matt, Syndergaard, DeGrom, all these guys are blossoming. And you have folk hero Big Sexy, folk hero Wilmer Flores, folk hero Cespedes, Terry's ass in the jackpot, all of these things. So what are we promoting, extending, and trading? Because as awesome as all these things were, all those eras were awesome, they all did kind of end, you know, just short of the finish line. All of them have their own distinct kind of what ifs. So I think that they all kind of fit that category of saudade.
I feel like if we could get back the I don't even remember what you called the era, because I don't remember the marketing at all, but if you could get back that 2006 to 2010 team and like run it all again, I think they actually have a pretty decent chance of winning a title.
Oh yeah, they should have won one,
right? Like if they get it, like, just, I know it's a meme for years that the Mets always complain about their injury luck, but objectively that 2006 team got absolutely fucked in the playoffs by injuries and like.
And they would have they should have won anyway with the injury.
They should have.
Yeah.
Also, kind of that would mean David Wright gets his ring.
I think this is a tough one because there's kind of for like the 98 to 2001 Mets are like my formative year Mets. Like that's my childhood team. I was 4 to 6. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So like that's growing up. Those are the teams that I remember first, but objectively the 05 to 06, 07, 08 teams were better. So like, I feel like they would have a better chance to win if you brought them back, and I feel like they would have. Like, those 99 to 2000 teams were good, but they got to the World Series. They weren't really a match for the Yankees. Like, they were worse than the Braves. You know what I mean? Like, they were legitimately not the best teams out there. But in 06, they were probably the best team in baseball. 07 and 08 had dumb collapses that they would have done way better in the playoffs otherwise. Like, it's just... there's more meat on the bone for those teams. And then the Panic City Mets, it's fine.
Yeah, I feel like individually that era of Mets, the Panic City Mets, like you have the biggest stars. I mean, Harvey was, I don't know if he was the best pitcher in baseball for like that year or two, but he was close.
I mean, Beltran was huge. I mean, more so
in the sense that, like, obviously, you know, David Wright was David Wright and Jose Reyes was Jose Reyes and Johan was probably the best pitcher in baseball that year.
But, I didn't feel famous, though. I get you.
Right. Like, it just seeing, like, all these guys, I guess also it kind of is a little different for us from we're following them from literally draft day to this guy is the guy now, you know? But, like, that era, it feels like it had, like, the most individual bright stars, just one after another after another after another, just churning them out. But at the same time, I don't know, that kind of also felt like the team itself was the least impressive. You had all these like stars and a lot of star power in these individual players, but you know, 2015 and 2016 were the only two good years, and then everything around them just kind of felt like crap.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, the 2017 Mets sucked. That was not fun. It immediately got not fun again.
Right, at least the other eras, you know, in the late 90s and 2000s. I mean, that kind of same situation, like, it got really not fun really quick. But, I don't know, it just felt, again, same thing like you were saying. Like, those are, I think, our formative years for the most part, you know, Lucas notwithstanding.
Yeah, I mean, for me, and I was a little older than you guys would have been for, like, the early 2000s Mets, but my first real baseball, like, I watched games before, but the first time I really got into baseball was the 2006 run, so.
Also, I think that SNY has a big influence on all this, because you could literally watch every single game. Whereas beforehand, like, you know, obviously on weekends you would have the games on, but the games are not always on television beforehand. And
were they not? I don't remember. Obviously.
And you would have like the weekend games would be on like Channel 11 or Channel 5, whatever it was.
They'd be all over the place.
Right. Then there would some games would be on Fox Sports. Some games would be on ESPN. You know, it was a lot more difficult. And honestly, I don't know if every single game was televised, you know, in order to, you would have to listen if you wanted to, you know, listen to every single game. But as a kid, like,
that's kind of crazy to think about, right? Because in my mind, I can't imagine a Met game not being broadcast on TV like that.
Yes.
Or like on that's easily wild. Accessible TV. Right? That's crazy.
Agree. That's honestly, it's why I like baseball the most out of any. I mean, there's a million reasons why, but one of the things that I love about baseball is that, like, it doesn't matter, you know, except obviously the winter, but it doesn't matter spring, summer, fall. Like, you come home from work or whatever, and like, you can always count on there's just a game on. You know, you could watch it with
The Mets play four times a week.
Right. Exactly. Like, you can really watch the game and concentrate on it. You could just put it on in the background and do whatever you want, but there's always a game on. And before SNY, like, you didn't really always have that. And then, obviously, also, there's, you know, other eras of Mets baseball, the worst team money could buy, and the lovable loser Mets, and the 1986 Mets, but...
Yeah, but they won. Like, right. Get them out of here. I don't want to bring them back. They won already. It's fine. Give someone else their flowers.
I mean, you could also say they should have won more, and they, you know...
Well, the 86 team should have.
Yeah.
I mean, by their own admission, it seems pretty obvious anytime the team drags them back into the spotlight, they're like, guys, please, someone else win so we can stop doing this. Like, begging you.
They need another World Series winner for that alone, almost, to literally make another commercial. Like,
running out of 1969, guys.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so, well, hopefully some of the players that we're going to be talking about this week are key to the future Mets dynasty, in which they will win just, you know, World Series after World Series, like we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. We're going to obviously continue our 2023 top prospect countdown. Last week, we reviewed prospects 15 to 11. And that was right-handed pitcher Joel Diaz, third baseman Jacob Raymer, outfielder Stanley Consuegra, right-hand pitcher Mike Vasil, and right-handed pitcher Calvin Ziegler. So we're finally now in the top 10, the cream of the crop, the best players in the system. And starting out...
Where are they?
Well, I guess we'll discuss... Well, God, let's hope so.
Mm-hmm.
We'll start out with number 10, right-handed pitcher Dominic Hamill. Hamill was drafted in 2021, third round out of Dallas Baptist University. Originally, he went to a community college near his hometown, Yavapai Community College. Then he transferred to Dallas Baptist in his junior year. So-so numbers there. Obviously, he lost an entire year because of COVID, so that sucks. But he had a cumulative 4.28 ERA in 111 innings, with a 3.3 walk rate and a 13.2 strikeout rate. Dallas Baptist, they're very analytically advanced. You know, they have a reputation of being on the cutting edge of new baseball technology and new schools of thought regarding baseball philosophy and everything. And, you know, either Dominic Hamill already had, and it just kind of had gone unnoticed, or he developed there, whatever. Very impressive pitch characteristics. And they have helped him jump up the prospect list. He pitched in St. Lucie and Brooklyn this past season. He posted a combined 3.25 ERA in 119 innings with 83 hits allowed, 54 walks, and 145 strikeouts. Four-seam fastball, it's about average velocity for a right-hander, like 91, 94. But it has... well above average, you know, basically elite spin numbers. It averaged last season when he was in St. Lucie 2,460 RPM, which is basically almost 200 RPM higher than the major league average last season. And it peaked as high as 2,560, which is, like, you know, crazy. Obviously, we only have, like, broad stroke numbers, so we don't have, like, the more cutting edge things like spin efficiency or seam shifted wake, like those kinds of things. But based on the fact that it has, you know, insane numbers up in the zone, I think it's safe to say that it's, you know, backspin and the pitch is like rising life. His best secondary is a slider. Same thing. It has above average spin rate. It's a low 80s pitch, and then it has about 2,700 to 2,900 RPM of basically sharp vertical drop and then a little bit of horizontal movement. His curveball, same thing. Lots of spin, lots of movement. And really, his main issue right now, Hamill, is his command. You know, basically all of his pitches have a lot of spin, which means they have a lot of movement, which means that they're harder to command. This past season, his walk rate was, it wasn't disastrous. You know, 11.4% walk rate, 4.1 walks per nine. That's not horrible and nothing like that. But between 3 and 4 is optimal. Below 3 is great. And, you know, just would want him to cut back on a few walks here and there, shave it down by a little bit, and, you know, you're all good there. There's a lot to like with Hamill.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Hamill. I'll probably have another bold prediction about him this year, like I did last year, and it'll probably be wrong again, like it was last year. But
I know your prediction, you know, was that, you know, he's going to or can be an exceptional reliever.
Yeah.
I know other people have said that and see that as like his ultimate role. I don't see it. Not that he could be that, but I don't see the reason why you would want him. He has not done anything to warrant being moved from starting pitching, you know?
Sure. And I don't disagree. Like, he's not looked prohibitively bad as a starter, right? It's not like he breaks down in the fourth inning every time. It's not like he's walking six dudes per nine. At the same time, I think there's enough questions that I'm not confident he's going to be a starter. Lack of a third pitch. The control still isn't great. Things like that. And he's a little bit older. That was kind of my argument for why. Look, you can put him in the bullpen as like a multi-inning guy. Like, you don't need to make him a one-inning middle reliever, but you can utilize him as a fireman, like a Seth Lugo type role. That's something that basically every team in baseball is doing. His stuff will play up there, and he should move faster, and then you get to use his use his proverbial bullets more in the majors than languishing in the minors, because like I said, he's not old, but he's on the older side for a real prospect.
Yeah, that's a good thing to mention that I bring up. Was basically he was a senior signing, you know. Mm-hmm. He's 2 years in community college, and he transferred to Dallas Baptist in his junior year, but because of COVID, you know, everything got shut down, so he went back in what would have been his fourth year, but technically NCAA eligibility, like, basically just snapped and made 2020 go away. So technically he was still a junior, even though it was his fourth year. But yeah, he was like 23-24 this past season, which is getting a little long in the tooth for him.
Yeah, not 30, but
yeah.
I would agree more with that if the Mets had more pitching prospects, but they don't.
Yeah,
like I think as of right now, he's 2 in the system as a pitching prospect. So as a starting pitching prospect, so I don't really know how you could put him in the pen now. You know what I mean? If he was 6 or 7, then I was like, okay, sure, because you have other guys, but the Mets have an old rotation and they keep having to spend money on it because there's no one around to get called up to replace these guys who go in free agency and stuff. And not that you should have replaced DeGrom in free agency. Like, I mean, in your system, unless you have another star coming up, but or another really high end prospect coming up. But it would be nice if, even if he ends up as a 4 or 5 starter, that'll be money that they don't have to spend on a 4 or 5 starter that they could spend on Otani or Machado or whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if he throws a handful of innings and he's like not really that great and he's that's still a pretty big win.
Yeah, and like, let's say you bring him up as a starter and it doesn't work, then you could just put him in the bullpen then. It would take a little bit of a learning experience, I'm sure, and we saw it with like David Peterson this past season that he struggled with the transition, but also maybe Hamill won't struggle with the transition, you never know. But I would keep him as a starter for now until you get more guys in the system who leapfrog him, basically.
Sure.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I look at it.
I mean, generally speaking, I think a lot of teams should make the decision sooner to specialize, but like you said, there's no real depth there to pull from.
Yeah.
So ideally, you'd like to be able to use, say he gains a little on the fastball and can really lean into the high spin stuff in short bursts and relief. Ideally, you'd want to play towards that, or, you know, maybe chase that performance. If you have guys behind him who, you know, can backfill his role as a starter, but the Mets are not in a position to do so.
Yeah, they just aren't.
So, yep.
Maybe in a year or three. All right. Now, next, coming in at number 9 is shortstop Ronnie Mauricio.
Here and we go.
His placement at 9 caused a lot of moaning and gnashing of teeth among the readers. Not all of them, but a vocal minority. So before we get to that and why he's ranked 9, a little bit, about Ronnie. He was signed as an international free agent in 2017. Basically, he was the Mets' main guy that year. And he is coming off of a season this year where he hit 259, 296, 472 in 123 games with the Binghamton Rumble Ponies. He hit 26 homers, he stole 20 bases, and he drew 24 walks to 125 strikeouts. If you want to add in his 50 games in the Dominican Winter League, then you can add 5 more homers to that, 10 more stolen bases, 10 more walks, and 43 more strikeouts. And nobody doubts, none of us here doubt, that Ronnie Mauricio has insane tools. And he legit could be like a 30-30 shortstop if everything worked out. But at this point, really, there's no indication that the things that need to click for him to like take that next step are clicking. You know, his pitch recognition is poor. There's a lot of strikeouts. There's a lot of weak, ground balls and weak pop flies. You know, that's not great, but it's not the end of the world in and of itself, because he could then supplement that with like a decent amount of walks. But then he hasn't done that either. And it's just, it's not good. We all want to see him succeed, obviously. We all want him to turn into the next, Troy Tulowitzki or Manny Machado, but just nothing in his performance this year, last year, has really given any of us the confidence that he is moving in the right direction. And that is the biggest issue. And I think that's the source of the big disconnect in how people see Mauricio. The tools are there, absolutely, but the performance is not. The performance has not really gotten better, so you can't really say that he's been making much progress. And the one thing that he does need to like improve on is the hardest thing as a baseball player to improve on. So
it's a thing that dudes don't really get that much better at, frankly.
Yeah.
Like, dudes add power.
It's into, like, your hardwire.
Yes.
It's like how your brain works almost.
It's a vision thing. It's a brain thing. It's all like there's people like I was obviously getting into it in the comments a little bit about this, because I feel very ardently that Ronnie Mauricio is not a really great prospect. I didn't even have him in the top 10, and I honestly stand by that. People are like, well, how can you criticize his plate discipline numbers or his swing decisions? Like, he doesn't strike out that much. It's like, okay. First of all, he walks 4% of the time. He's still walking 4% of the time in the Dominican Winter League. There's no improvement there. And he's getting away with having enough bat to ball to just make a bunch of weak contact with shit. This is not dissimilar to – how do I phrase this? Ahmed Rosario is a very, very different prospect, but I think both he and Mauricio have this same sort of – a skill / flaw where, despite making generally poor swing decisions, their hand eye is good enough to get the bat on the ball against minor league stuff and make a lot of weak contact. And Ahmed was better at it than Maurizio is, which is why he never struck out this much and had higher batting averages and has made it work in the majors. Maurizio just kind of swings at everything and relies purely on his physical tools to put wood on ball and then have no real impact when doing so. It's like, this is the most important skill, and he's made no progress in it since 2018. I don't know why we're still pretending that this is something that's going to magically get better.
If it does, great, but there's no projecting it anymore.
Right, that's exactly. I mean,
you can't bake in it growing into your evaluation anymore, essentially.
Right, I think that's the perfect way of why, you know, this year we are a lot lower on him than last year or the year before, especially because at a certain point, you know, put up or shut up. And yes, he's young.
No learning has occurred here. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like, he's young. Yes. Okay. He's facing guys that are older than him, have more experience than him, all things that are valid, but there have been no visible signs of progress, which is not optimal.
Okay. So I'm looking at Fangraphs right now.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, as a 21-year-old, Ronnie Mauricio, like you said, hit 259, 296, 472, which is a 104 WRC+. Ahmed Rosario at 20 in 2016 in Double A, hit 341, 392, 381. So, like, while Ahmed was a very flawed prospect because of the lack of walks and he didn't have crazy power, you know. Like, that, you look at that and you just have to respect what he did. Like he hit the shit out of the ball. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, the problems for him wasn't that he wasn't talented. It's that his flaws got exacerbated when you get promoted because you're facing better stuff and everything else. And he's not a bad major league player. He's not an exceptionally good one. He wouldn't be the number one prospect in baseball today if we're looking at it and through modern. I don't want to say modern because that's only 7 years ago, but modern ways to look at prospects, but he would be on the top 100. He would probably be in the back end of that, but you know what I mean? And yeah. then everything kind of feels a little different for him. And then he repeated Double A a little bit the next year. Oh, sorry. No, he didn't. He got moved up to Triple A and he was worse. 328, 370, 367, 466 with a 116 WRC+, which isn't horrible, obviously. Like, he wasn't terrible, but you know. And the thing with Mauricio is just, he doesn't even have the bat to ball skills either, because he's hitting 250. Like, I know batting average is an outdated stat, but when you're a prospect and you're hitting 250 in Double A, what are you going to do in the majors?
You better be hitting for more game power than,
like, it's. I'm not saying that you have to hit 300 to be a good major leaguer. That's not true. But even the guys who hit 250 in the majors were hitting 300 in the minors because they were better than the minor league competition. And I just don't really know what you do with Mauricio either. That's the other weird part.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's going to make the majors, I don't think he'll be like a one and done guy, or he'll never make it or whatever. He might bounce around some bad teams, but he gets the Javi Baez comp a lot. But Baez has, like, legendarily special bat to ball. Like,
can I give you Baez's
is a
line?
Complete outlier.
Go ahead, Lucas.
Here's Baez's Double A line at 20 years old. 294, 346, 638, with 20 home runs in 240 plate appearances.
Is the 600 slugging percentage good?
Is 640 slugging percentage?
No.
That's a 180 weighted.
That's like...
comparable players.
And
Ronnie Mauricio does not have this much raw power, speed, or defensive value.
And the thing is, like, I know, like, I was always a Baez fan, just the aesthetics of it were so fun. Like, a guy who just goes up there and doesn't give a shit, just swings, and he made it work for a long time. But when I was watching him on the Mets, it obviously wasn't peak Baez or anything, but you could see how peak Baez was like, oh, yeah, this dude, the way he makes contact and the type of stuff he makes contact with, most people don't do that. you know?
No.
Like, I don't want to see people comp hobby bias to anyone, because that's like a one of one skill, because otherwise that should not have worked. And that's
Do we lose Thomas mid sentence there?
Oh damn.
Unfortunate.
Well, his point was that you can't see Javi Baez's success and say, okay, Mauricio is going to follow that path. Because,
like, if you want to talk about a prospect that's like Javi Baez in any way, it's Ellie De La Cruz. And Ellie De La Cruz is such a freak that he breaks, like, every evaluation skill you could possibly have, because he whiffs in this.
Why you don't comp outliers.
Yes. Like,
extremes.
There's a reason Ellie De La Cruz is like the fourth best prospect, fifth best prospect in baseball, somewhere in the top 10 prospects in baseball. Like, he has first of all, his decisions I don't think are even as bad as Mauricio. His whiff rate is worse, but he chases less, I think. But he has much more impact when he hits the ball, in like orders of magnitude more physical talent. And I'm not saying Mauricio isn't physically talented, but he's not in that echelon. Like, there are not the accessory skills to buoy a profile with this sort of flaw are not really present. Like, if he figures it out, he's going to be an okay, like, third baseman. Great. Wonderful. I'm really excited. Like, we haven't talked about his defense at all. I don't think he's a shortstop.
I think he's fine as a shortstop. Like, you don't need to be above average at everything. He's always shown enough range. His instincts kind of...
I'd put him in, like, the cabbie category of, like, guy who, if you position him well enough,
he can
play there for a season.
I don't think
ultimately, I see him playing third.
He's never going to, like, be a big great guy. Shortstop, yeah. But he can play it. The arm is, you know...
Enough.
Good. So, yeah, exactly. Like, you know, you can play a passable shortstop and it's good enough. But the problem is, again, now the bat. And if you have an shortstop with a major questionable bat, then it's just like, well, what do you have?
And I would also, like, there's a lot of people who come out and say, look, he's only 21. He has time to improve on this. And yeah, he's 21. And I will admit, this is anecdotal. Like, I've not sat down and done the analysis to prove this. But I think it's pretty safe to say that this is the hardest part of hitting to actually improve. Like, we already talked about, like, guys improve their power. Guys improve their spray distribution. We've seen guys improve on defense. We've seen guys get faster. Improving your decisions to this degree, and not just becoming more selective and like, if it was just a chase thing, maybe I'd have more faith in it, but it's not just a chase thing. So I don't know. I just have very little faith that the magnitude of improvement he needs to make in this department is feasible or going to happen.
Yep, that pretty much sums it up. Is that, can he? Yeah, he could, in theory. Will he? Good question.
My internet going out mid Ronnie Mauricio rant is very funny.
Mm-hmm.
The powers that be have silenced you.
Much like his on base percentage,
yeah.
my internet, my Spectrum internet has crashed. Cratered.
Thomas was being too positive about Mauricio, so I cut his internet to stop.
And
this.
I wasn't even.
Like, I know.
The big Mauricio lobby silenced you.
Uh-huh. The Mauricio cabal is here.
I got silenced by Big Ronnie, but but in all actuality, what I was saying, I think, when I got cut out, because I wasn't sure when the internet went out. But it's just how you view him is, I think, how it's so different, or how you view a prospect. Like, this is a guy Lucas will never like, even if he was
Correct.
Better than this. He would just like the whole thing is just something that the way that Lucas looks at prospects would never like him, you know? Yep. And not saying that you're right or wrong or whatever. It's just, this is, he's such a divisive prospect that I could understand. Like, one of my friends really likes him because he's like the power and the athleticism and he can play shortstop. And I was like, I understand. But mm-hmm. he literally does not hit the ball enough. So it doesn't yep. matter. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's so, there's just other, there's different ways to look at prospects. And he's one of the guys, like, you could look at a pitcher and be like, well, that's a good fastball. And if it's a, if you say it's a bad one and it's a good one, then you're just wrong. But with this, it's almost the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And our comment section really likes the loud tools that he has. And he certainly has them. Like, even when he's having a 100 WRC plus, he's hitting 25 home runs, but, or whatever he hit. I think it was 25.
28? It was a lot. Yeah,
that's a lot of home runs in the minor leagues. Like, that's really impressive. But when you watch the clips and he's on his game, it's like, oh, wow. And I've seen him. I went to go see him, and I'm like, wow, he looks really good today. And then you'll see him again, and you're like, wow, he looks horrible. And mm-hmm. it's like, it almost depends on the look you get. He's such a weird player because it could be anything at any given time. But, yeah, it's just how you look at prospects, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, I will eternally underrate a guy like Ahmed Rosario or Ronnie Mauricio because I just hate this profile, and I'll also probably overrate Jacob Reamer, which, you know, played out in the way we submitted our rankings, I think. But, yeah, I'm get back to me when his on-base percentage starts with a 3. How about that? Like, that's just where I'm at with Mauricio at this point.
Yeah. I wouldn't really care about the batting average if he walked.
Yeah, I don't give a shit. Like,
because then I'd be like, oh, cool, he's a walk-powered, athletic sort of shortstop who you move to third base or whatever, or out of the outfield because of Lindor.
But if he walked, if you gave Ronnie Mauricio, I'm trying to come up with an example, the Mets system. God, I'm struggling.
They don't really have a lot. The Mets system is not the best system to use.
They don't have a lot of patient hitters, really. Like, Alvarez isn't patient. Beatty is fine. Whatever. Let's say you gave him, like, Brett Beatty's walk rate. I would love this prospect then. Be like, oh, shit, he's only going to bat 230, but I don't really care because his on-base percentage is 350. He has a ton of power, and I can squint and put him at shortstop. That's like a global top 50-ish prospect. But he's 7 points of walk rate away from that, and that's a big deal.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Obviously, we hope that Mauricio takes those steps. I don't think we have much faith, but here's hoping. All right, next up at number 8 is third baseman Mark Vientos. And he feels like he's been around forever. He was drafted in 2017. He's worked his way up the system. And this past year, he hit 280, 358, 519 with 24 home runs in 101 games in Syracuse, 44 walks, and 122 strikeouts. Started the season a bit slow, but got on a roll after about a month or so. And he ended the year basically in the top. He was actually in the top 13th. To be specific, in the International League in OPS, adjusted to players who played at least, you know, 75 games in the league, basically, you know, majority of the season. So yeah, it's hard to say if the book on Vientos is closed, because he literally, you know, he literally did turn just 23 like a month and a half ago or so. But we have a few seasons of data now, and they all more or less say the same exact thing. He starts out slow, takes a couple weeks to adjust. He's got light tower power, especially the opposite field, because he's a strong dude and he has a long swing. But that long swing that generates a lot of power could be taken advantage of by, you know, above average velocity or good breaking stuff. And that has been the case in the past. Complicating things, of course, is the fact that, you know, as a third baseman, he is a negative defender, And if he was a better defensive player, okay, you know, you could say, well, you know, there's more breathing room, whatever, but he really does not provide any kind of positive defensive value, so all of his worth is tied to the bat. And, you know, the kind of player that he is with that kind of profile, there are questions as to whether or not it will translate at the major league level. In the minor league level, against AA pitching, against AAA pitching, he's destroyed them. And that's great. Major league pitching is a whole different beast altogether. I don't know. You know, his numbers are eerily similar to Bryce Brent's, the former Red Sox prospect. He never panned out, really.
That's a name.
Yeah. Jeez.
At the same time, though, they also profile... No, but they also profile very similar to Nolan Gorman. And, you know, he's hasn't been written off yet, and he still has a promising future ahead of him. So we can keep our fingers crossed. And unlike Ronnie Mauricio, we were just talking about, who has a lot of the same issues with strikeouts and walks, at least Vientos, A, he does take a walk, and B, he does have a track record of success. So, I don't know.
I mean, Vientos' problem is not as much approach, just whiff rate in zone, right? You can really divide, like, you can subdivide this concept further and further, but at least in my mind, there's two big groups, right? You make decisions, and then you have contact questions. Ronnie Mauricio is good at contact and terrible at decisions. I think Mark Vientos is actually okay at decisions, except, like, bad right-on-right matchups. Like,
yeah.
He gets eaten up by whatever. That's, like, normal. Guys can improve at that aspect of it, but he really struggles with in-zone contact rate, and that's concerning. That's not something I would expect him to improve a ton. I think there's certainly more utility. Like, I like is it weird that I'm higher on him after this past season than I was going into 2022? Because I feel like most people are the opposite after last season.
I mean, you could look at it two ways. You could say after the past season, you can say, okay, here's all of the flaws that I've seen in him at AAA, and that's not going to play at the major league level. Or you could say, look, another year where he succeeded, not only succeeded, but dominated at the highest levels of the minor leagues. So I don't know. I guess it depends on if you're pessimistic or optimistic.
And I think, like, look, there are a lot of underlying problems with his AAA numbers, right? His ground ball rate was very high. Like I said, the contact rates were bad. The exit velocity numbers are good, but not outstanding.
He has big splits too.
Yeah, you're probably looking at like a right platoon bat, and that's not something super exciting, but it's also a little bit more than I thought he was. Like, I wasn't even convinced he would be that, and now I kind of do think he'd function just fine as a righty platoon bat. Maybe not immediately, like, you got to give him a little adjustment period, but I wouldn't hate having Mark Vientos on the bench.
I think that he's going to end up there by the end of the year in some capacity.
Yeah. I mean, if Ruff looks just as cooked in spring training, I think there's a chance you carry him north.
I mean, isn't that what Pham's going to do?
Yeah, theoretically, I guess. I mean, Pham's
and
also
Pham complained. He hit lefties pretty well last year. He had pretty severe splits. But like you said, there's a non-zero chance Pham was going to have to play outfield for Marte had surgery. I don't remember, but it was elite enough to they don't know how he's going to start camp. So
I don't know what the hell they're going to do with the bench, right? Like, are you going to take Beatty? Are you going to take Vientos? Are you going to take Alvarez? Like, I don't know what the hell. Are you going to just keep Ruff and roll with it and hope, like,
and see if Ruff is actually bad or if it was just a bad luck thing? And you could do well. There's a lot of breathing room. But I don't know. I don't like Vientos, but also I understand that he is a player who will play a lot of major league games for someone, whether it's the Mets or someone else. Like, a team will roster him as half a DH, even if it's like the Pirates or the Athletics or something. Like, that's not nothing. I don't like him, but he's going to – there isn't way more of a chance Vientos is more productive for the 2023 Mets than Ronnie Mauricio is, or – or the 2024 Mets than Ronnie Mauricio is too. Just out of pure, there's a, if you shelter him in what he's doing enough, he'll be fine.
Yep.
Just have to be smart about it.
And like, I think we also, at least for me, I find myself thinking about these prospects as if the Mets, as if we're dealing with the old Mets still, where they would be thinking about giving the third base job to someone like Mark Vientos, and that would be a disaster. But
no, yeah.
With a competently run organization, it's a nice piece. It's piece to have around, right? Like, again, you're not gonna, if Pete Alonso pulls a hammy and has to miss 2 to 3 weeks, you can live with Mark Vientos being on the major league roster. Like, it's not Pete Alonso, but it'll be fine. Probably.
It's not. It's not. Whoever the hell they would normally have out there either.
They've had a lot of journeyman first baseman hanging out at a.
It's not James Loney.
who was the dude that I know I was clamoring for them to call up and then they traded to the Padres? This was in like the teens somewhere. Dykstra or something like that?
Oh. Cutter Dykstra.
What?
Cutter Dykstra?
No,
it was a Cutter Dykstra, but I don't remember. There was two Dykstras. One was Lenny's son, the other one was not.
I don't think it was that. No, it wasn't.
What position?
It was like a first baseman who was mashing in AAA, and then they wound up sending him to the Padres in like a minor deal. I'm absolutely failing to come up with it. Anyway, like, they've had a lot of random-ass AAA first baseman, and Vientos would be a better option as, like, a temporary injury replacement than any of them.
Yep. All right, next up, coming in at number 7, is outfielder Alexander Ramirez. He was signed by the Mets at the start of the 2019 to 2020 international signing period. He was their main guy that year. COVID obviously happened and it complicated things. So when the 2021 season started, the Mets basically they said screw it, and they threw Alex Ramirez into the deep end and skipped him over the DSL completely. They, I'm assuming that he looked good in extended spring training for them to do this. But they basically threw him and rostered him at St. Lucie without having any organized baseball experience whatsoever. And he basically held his own, which is great. He hit 258, 326, 384, 5 home runs, 15 stolen bases, and 23 walks to 104 strikeouts. And then this past season, he started the year at St. Lucie, and he played his way up to Brooklyn. He had a pretty similar season, a little bit better, which is good. You want to see that. He hit 281, 346, 436 with 11 homers, 21 stolen bases, and 44 walks to 122 strikeouts. And Ramirez is super toolsy. He has a hit tool that projects hopefully to be average. The power projects to be average. Speed is above average, borderline plus. Arm is above average. Fielding is above average. Basically, all the ingredients are there to kind of be a Starling Marte-ish player to replace Starling Marte when his contract expires in a couple years. The thing is, and similar to the guys, you know, similar to Mauricio, in that the biggest issue with him taking the next step forward is his ability to put wood on ball. Ramirez has a kind of funky swing. And when I said that his hit tool projects to be average-ish, maybe that's kind of being a little generous. But he's also very young at this point, so we don't know if the weird swing that he has is going to be something that he just does and he's able to do it because, you know, he has the bat speed and the strength and all that. Or once he's now starts seeing, you know, better curveballs and sliders and changeups and everything in Double A, presumably next year, if that's, you know, they're going to eat him alive. It's a weird swing. It's hard to explain. You just have to, like, see a video of it. It's like Kevin Parada level weird. Kevin Parada obviously made it work in college. And, you know,
Alexander Ramirez has made it work at the lower levels of the minors so far, next year is going to be the test.
I'm less concerned about how the swing looks and more concerned that I think his performance was like the underlying metrics of his performance were not in line with the top line numbers, I think is a fair way to put it. He's nice. I'm not as high on Ramirez as you guys are, I don't think.
I like him. He's interesting to me. But yeah, like it's not like he's a perfect prospect, and it's not like the underlying stuff isn't concerning. I just think there's room to be excited for him, about him, I mean, and also understand that those numbers got to get better. But also, he's young.
And like, if you guys with weird swings make it work, I mean, this really fits into what Thomas said about Mauricio. Like, this is not a guy I'm going to like as much, right? I don't think the decisions are great, and maybe this is actually a swing thing. Like, don't know that his launch angles are ever going to be particularly optimized, but we'll see. He's a dude who I think you could really try to capitalize on his value now.
By trading him?
Yeah. I don't know for what exactly. The team's pretty good at the major league level, but
I think we're past that for the offseason.
Yeah.
Just unless something crazy happens, like these are the teams that we'll be rolling with most of the way. In regards to other teams, I mean, like, I don't think anyone's trying to make sweeping major league changes to their roster now. There's just no way. Unless someone's, you're not even with salary cap stuff, because it's all that stuff's over. Not salary cap, luxury tax contract stuff. Like all that, all those decisions are made. So, like, I think if you're at the deadline and someone's dangling a very good bat, you're like, well, hey, the Mets are in first place. Let's go win a World Series, you know?
Mm-hmm. Pirates want to dangle Will Bednar. I'll go trade Alex Ramirez for him in a heartbeat.
Sure.
And like that's the type of stuff where I could see him also being reliable. Or not reliable.
Valuable.
Valuable. Yes. There we go. Thank you. I knew it was an valuable word.
Sorry, not Will Bednar. David Bednar.
David. Yes.
Yeah.
Will Bednar is the mediocre Giants prospect.
And yes, Alan Dykstra, is he the first base guy you were talking about?
Yes, that's it. Alan Dykstra. Thank you. I've been trying to pull up Syracuse rosters this whole time.
Because they weren't in Syracuse.
I didn't. Yeah,
they were in Vegas. That's why. God damn. Alan Dykstra is 35 years old now. Jesus.
We are Alan Dykstra posting. I wonder where he's up. If you're listening, Alan Dykstra, you had fans at Amazing Avenue.
Oh, I guess he went to Tampa, not the Padres. But yeah, he like murdered. This was during like the peak Ike versus Duda debates, and I'm like Alan Dykstra, and he never really got
it. Consider a third option.
Yes,
put him in center.
Well, he did kill. Like he had a once. His 2012 to 2014, we're really off track now. He had a 141 weighted in AA, then a 164 again in AA, and then a 145 in AAA. Like, dude was mashing in the minors, but whatever. Oh, I thought he was a Padre because he came from the Padres originally. Yeah. All right, I'm not insane. Okay.
There is a connection. All right, now last guy we're going to discuss this week, coming in at number 6, is right-handed pitcher Blade Tidwell. And the Mets drafted him this past season with their second-round pick. He was the 52nd player selected overall. He was projected to go much higher. In some of the earlier mock drafts, some of them had him going like the early to mid-teens, and one of the first college pitchers, one of the first college pitchers coming off the board, but just basically right before the season started, it was announced that he was going to miss the start of the season due to a shoulder injury. It wasn't bad enough that he was going to need surgery, but it was one of those things where, you know, just let time heal it. So he missed about 2 months or so. And then when he was able to finally get back on the field for Tennessee, he was treated with kid gloves, you know, basically throwing an inning or so an outing. But by the end of the season, like May-ish or whatever, he was throwing multiple innings. He still never really threw that many innings. The most he threw in a single game was like seven. Most of them were like three-inning, four-inning kind of deals. But, you know, in the limited innings that he did throw, he looked good. So the Mets selected him. And then in the limited innings that he's thrown with the Mets so far, he's looked good. He has 19 innings total between the FCL Mets and St. Lucie in the regular season. And then St. Lucie doing the championship run. He has thrown 19 innings in total. He's given up 2 runs on 9 hits, 9 walks, and 24 strikeouts. Stuff-wise, I mean, you can't argue with the stuff. Fastball sits in like the mid-90s. It tops out 98 or so. The four-seamer, it has, you know, above-average spin rates and ride. The two-seamer, it has arm side life and sink. Good fastball. Secondary pitch, the best one that he throws is a slider. Very sharp vertical drop, little bit of horizontal slice, and it gets tons of strikeouts. Curveball, you know, it has similar movement, but it doesn't have that razor-sharp movement like the slider does. It's a little bit bigger. But it also gets swings and misses. The changeup, pretty solid pitch by itself. And really the only issue is that, not that he struggles to throw it, but he telegraphs it. And in theory, anyway, that's a fairly easy fix. Yeah.
Yep.
So, like, the biggest thing, I guess, with Blade Tidwell, if you want to look at the negatives here, is that, you know, similar to what we were talking about Dominic Hamill, there are some concerns about his command because the pitches move a lot. So, you know, they're harder to command. His control is good. Like, he could throw the ball in the zone and, you know, a lot of times, you know, he won't hit his spot, but it'll still be in the zone. And, you know, sometimes that's good because, OK, cool, you can sneak a strike. But a lot of times it's not good because you just threw a big fat pitch and it's in the strike zone and that's going to get hit. So, you know, just he needs to command the pitches better. And also, we can't overlook this, is the fact that he's coming off of a shoulder injury. And yeah, so far it looks like he's recovered fine. You know, we haven't heard about any soreness. The performance was obviously great. But, you know, shoulder injuries are shoulder injuries, and he's a pitcher. So it's not something that we can just, you know, completely ignore, even though he really hasn't shown any kind of lingering issues with it.
Yeah, I really like this pick because I think he's a first-round talent easily that fell because of injuries. And mm-hmm. If you're the Mets, you take that swing because – you got your two first-round talents in the first round that we'll talk about next week, and you're still able to add basically a third one. Now, obviously, it has some red flags in terms of medicals, but they're all pitchers, man. They all have red flags because of their medicals, even the ones who are healthy. You know, it's just not a natural bodily function, so I'm not too concerned about – not that I'm not too concerned about it, but it's more like it wouldn't have detracted me from drafting him either. If he's there in the second, it's easy money for me.
I think if he's healthy, now here's the question, right? If he's healthy, how high does he go in the first round? Which is hard to say because there was so much weird stuff in the draft this year, like.
And also, we don't know how good he would have been. Like, if he pitched and was amazing, then we're looking at top 10, 15.
I mean, I like him more than Cade Horton. I like him more than Gabriel Hughes, I think. Maybe that's a hot take.
I think that Tidwell is definitely a guy that has been and maybe will continue to be overlooked by, you know, like just on people on a national level until all of a sudden, you know, he's ending the season with like a 2.3 ERA in, you know,
mm-hmm.
100 innings with 13 Ks per nine and 4 walks per 9 or something, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden people are like, oh shit, like, wow, this guy's good.
You also have to give him time to, at least in my mind, I need more time between the present and the shoulder injury for me to be confident that he will stay healthy. And that's a big component to ranking him higher, right? Mm-hmm. Like the further he gets away from that recovery, the more like I'm never going to fully trust the shoulder, but I'll be like, okay, it seems like it's holding up. This is going well. The stuff isn't backing up. I really liked this pick at the time. I think the early returns have looked quite good, and if he stays healthy, this is a real nice pickup. Like kudos on this pick, that was very well done.
Yeah, it's just a really good way to get more talent in the system, in a system that really needs it. And I think obviously the Kumar Rocker stuff had a very bad. Like, that draft is terrible now because you didn't really get anyone from it. But Rocker isn't probably not good. And then you're getting three high-end. Like, I'd rather Tidwell than Rocker easily. I don't even think that's much of a question among any circles at this point.
No, yeah, but, easily no, absolutely. For me. Now, there is a question there of how much is that the Rangers fucking him up because they don't know what they're doing. Course. But, yeah.
I definitely blame them. I'm not saying it's Rocker's fault. I think it's the Rangers not knowing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty much a very common thread among their prospects. But they kind of save that. I think that helps not save it. But when they walked away with last draft with three first-round talents. And they got one because they were able to say, hey, I know your shoulder is a little borked and you barely pitched this year. But for another team who only had that one pick, they can't take the risk on a second rounder. They need that to be safer. But when you take Parada, who fell to you, and we'll talk about that next week, but who fell to you and is a really good prospect and one that nobody expected you to get. And then Jet Williams, who I felt like everyone expected the Mets to get, but is a guy that everyone really, like a lot of people, high school level evaluators really like. And I've grown to really understand it and get it. But then you could do that. You could draft a guy like this. Because you have risk baked in.
I feel like Mets, again, I like going back to what the old Mets would have done here, like previous regimes. Like, I feel like in this spot, instead of taking an interesting gamble on a dude with, I don't actually know whether his, at least it to my visual inspection, seems like analytically friendly stuff. I've not pulled the numbers on it, but old Mets teams would wound up taking like Tyler Locklear, a corner bat who performed in college, or maybe they would have been the ones to grab Ben Joyce, or there was another name, or Cade Doughty, right? They would have picked one of these performers who would almost certainly not go anywhere. And I don't want to who knows what happens with these guys, but they're doing more intelligent things with these picks, and I think Tidwell is both really indicative of that and seems to actually be working. Like, good process, and they're getting the results are pointing in the right direction.
And I feel like I've said this every week since we talked about the draft, but just keep doing this and eventually the players will hit. Even if these individual guys don't hit in 2, 3, 4 years, you will get guys who will, and then you combine that with the money and you got a real stew going.
Yep. And they got a, like they're, it's it's on them to improve their development pipelines now, right? Like, okay, you're doing smarter things in the draft. Your amateur acquisition is better. Now figure out your development processes and actually make a good stew instead of a bland, boring mess of disappointment and sadness.
And to their credit, they seem to be hiring a lot of people.
Yep.
They seem to be, I feel like every week or 2 weeks or so now, we're getting the tweets from some guy who works at some facility who's like, I can't wait to be the Mets AAA coach. Can't wait to get started. I'm like, oh, okay, cool.
The Mets are paying me like three times the going rate for this position. So that
exactly, because they know that they want me here, which is a good thing. That's what that's another part of Steve's money that fans don't see, but will absolutely help in ways that we can't even fathom.
Yep.
Which is also not doing anything for his bank account at all. Like, Cohen doesn't give a shit about any. Like, that's like, he made it back by the time he signed the contract.
Correct.
Now, here's an interesting question I was just thinking of. Obviously, you know, we can't say the players that are ranked ahead of Tidwell. We haven't gotten there yet, but an astute observer can put two and two together and figure out the five guys that haven't been talked about that are, you know, still out there. We know
Wait, Steve, can I get
Luis
one
Carpio.
Hint? Can I get the one
Carpio,
hint?
Top three.
It's not Nick Morbido. Please stop talking about Nick Morbido.
Why did you? Damn.
We were
you
so
gave cool. it away.
Number one overall prospect, Nick Morbido.
You want to say we're edgelords? This is edgy, baby. Yeah,
it's Morbido. My favorite prospect is in the system is when Nick Morbido said it's Morbin time and morbed all over the other prospects.
So we know who's ahead of Tidwell. We know who's behind Tidwell. Based on presumably who is going to lose their rookie eligibility, their prospect eligibility that are ranked ahead of Tidwell, and the guys that are ranked below Tidwell, what are the odds that Blade Tidwell is the Mets' number one prospect next season?
One?
Yeah, less than five.
Really?
I think he'll be top three.
Yes. But, yeah, if you had said third, I would give you a pretty high number. But
one and two, I have two guys in mind specifically that I think will be one and two.
I don't think there's any way either of them graduate. Like, there's like 0% chance one of them graduates and a very low chance that the other one does.
The two guys that we're all talking about, that again, I'm sure it's not that difficult to put two and two together to figure out who they are. Neither one of them is going to graduate, I don't think. Yeah. I mean, the system, something would have to be, I don't know what would have to happen.
It would either have to be amazing or terrible, and I don't know which is more likely.
I don't see that happening. Now, if the question is he going to be the third best prospect in the system, I think there's a real strong chance that that's where he... Third best prospect and, like, let's say back end or borderline top 100 guy?
Yep, that's what I think is going to end up happening.
I don't think that's a... even at all that bold of a take to say if his shoulder is healthy, Blade Tidwell will be a back end top 100 prospect next year.
Agree.
Now that is a big if, unfortunately, because shoulder injuries are just awful.
Like, right. They're
terrible.
This whole thought experiment can go when it's announced in 2 days that his shoulder just gave out and he's getting rotator cuff surgery.
There's a reason every BP pitcher blurb since like 2018 ends with also he's a pitcher in some way or another. Like, it's just the reality.
I'm more bullish. I think that I think that one player is pretty much guaranteed to be the top prospect next year, assuming that, you know, players graduate and everything like that. I think the second player does not have as big a chance as Tidwell does.
Assuming I know the ordering you're implying, and this will be an interesting discussion next week, I really disagree with what you're saying.
Well, we'll see. I mean, also, I put more of an emphasis on proximity than I do. And, you know, one player that we're talking about, he happens to be pretty low in terms of proximity. And so I have the list in front of me. I'm trying to look where everyone else rated. And I was the lowest man on him, ranking him. So it makes sense.
This should be fun to talk about next week then.
We will have a good discussion. Definitely will have.
And I don't have to think about Ronnie Mauricio again until next year when we do this all over again.
Well, if anyone has any questions, comments, whatever, you could send us an email at our email address for now, from complextoqueens@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter and shoot us questions there. I am at Steve Seipel. Lucas is at elvalajos343. Ken is at ken1191. And Thomas is at SadMetSeason, SZN. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. Rate and review it. And of course, we thank you for listening. And we will be back next week. So until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.